is a relatively general talk rather than a detailed talk on some ideas I've been having about how to maybe constrain the suitable parameter space we're playing with our theories of quantum gravity. I'm going to start out pointing out that because everyone gets confused about Victoria University, it's the one down there, not the one in Vancouver. Okay, it's the one in New Zealand we're talking about. The other thing is, since no one seems to have noticed, it is the 5th of November, and who does remember the gunpowder treason and plot? Yeah? If you live in England, you know about it. It was an early attempt at parliamentary reform in England involving several hundred barrels of gunpowder located in the basement. And this is the day on which the poor bastard was finally caught, tongue drawn, and quartered. But anyway, now let's actually get down to some physics. This is the abstract I sent in, and the point of my talk is that while it's become increasingly common over the last few years to look at Lorentz violating theories as possible signals of quantum gravity, and while we've started to vastly explore this tremendous parameter space of possible extensions to special relativity and general relativity, my point is maybe it's overkill. Looking at arbitrary violations of Lorentz invariance is an interesting exercise that might be overkill compared to where the most likely places are to start looking. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time here today trying to convince people it's worth reducing the parameter space of the things to look at. The standard thing people look at is you start with a ordinary Lorentz invariant dispersion relation, and in its most general case, you just replace that by some function of omega and k equals zero, or when you're talking to the mathematicians, you apply the implicit function theorem to rewrite that as frequency is some arbitrary function of momentum. And while you can certainly do that, I would argue that in general that is too general a thing to be looking at. In particular, I'm going to start with hypothesis H1. Gravity is not just CPT, but it's CP and T. Now, it's easy to forget in this welter of models that we've got that the theory we're actually starting from, Einstein gravity, is certainly individually invariant under CP and T. And the only known observational example of parity violation or time invariance violations is in the electroweak sector, and it apparently seems to have nothing to do with gravity. Certainly there's not a single gravitational experiment I'm aware of that directly indicates a necessity for P or T violations. So my principle is simply going to be, first principle is, don't add more complication than is necessary. Let's see how far we can go maintaining P and T invariance to keep some control over what we're actually doing. So that's hypothesis one. Working hypothesis one, maintain both P and T invariance. This constrains the terms that you can show up in the dispersion relation. Basically, whenever you have an omega, it better show up as omega squared. That is T invariant. If I've got a k, it better show up as a k squared, possibly contracted with some tensor. That is parity invariant. What else can I write down? Well, if I've got something that transforms light to velocity, I can certainly take the inner product of that velocity with a wave vector, contract that. That is then invariant under, well, it's invariant under P, it's not invariant under T, but if I multiply it by omega, then by God, that combination is invariant under P and T. And similarly, V dot K, V, the only thing I'm saying at this stage, it's something that behaves like a velocity. I'm not at this stage of the argument claiming it is a velocity. as long as it has the standard transformation properties on the PFT or a velocity that we mentioned, this is a basis of terms we've got available to play with that are both P and T invariant, and we can shove into our dispersion relation. This thing H I've written down is some 3x3 matrix, and if you want desperately a model for it, think of it like a dielectric matrix, a matrix of dielectric coefficients, and it's something that should be P and T even, which is actually what dielectric permittivity does for you. So at this stage, with my first working hypothesis, I've got some sort of basis of sensible things to look at, and this lets me write down my dispersion relation in the form, it's some function of omega squared, omega v dot k squared, h contracted with k twice, equals zero. I'm going to now slightly improve my basis. No one can stop me from replacing omega v dot k with these three terms. It's just a linear combination of the things I was playing with. And I think some of you will see now where I'm going to be heading. Because now I'm simply going to rewrite my dispersion relation this way in terms of omega squared, omega minus v dot k squared, v dot k squared h. And this is the most general dispersion relation that I can write down that is simultaneously P and T invariant. And let's see where this now leads us. Because for my next hypothesis, I'm going to say time derivatives higher than second order tend to be problematic.
Can I ask one quick question? Yeah. Why cannot only allow omega v dot k, and you need the v dot k squared as well, so as to complete the full square?
You could keep it by itself, but it's, I'm going to get rid of it eventually.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have but, omega v dot k, but
the, but by itself, you require more than just P and T invariance to get rid of that. Okay. If I'm just using P and T invariants, I still have to leave this one around.
This is fine, but okay. I don't have to.
But eventually I'm going to get rid of this, and I'm going to get rid of this by playing a few tricks. But that's going to require more than P and T invariants. In fact, my second hypothesis, not too unreasonable, is going beyond second order and time derivatives generally causes problems. Generally, you find that if you've got something that's third or fourth order and time derivatives, you wind up with ghosts, you wind up with unitarity violations, you wind up with a right mess. There's a minor exception. Fresnel relations exist in crystals, are definitely more than second order in time. Yep.
Does this problem also occur for infinite order derivatives?
In principle, it will. Even if you've got infinite order derivatives in time, it requires extra work to make sure that you don't have ghosts showing up in the spectrum.
What is the extra work?
The extra work really has to be done on a case-by-case basis, looking at your particular example. So give me a particular example. There's a whole structure that goes back to what Ostrogoski and company on how to deal with higher-order time derivatives. But essentially, there's no grand, unified, simple answer I can give you.
They have only finite number of derivatives.
The Ostrogoski formalism is a finite number of derivatives. But infinite number of derivatives, the same general principles apply, but it has, really has to be a case-by-case analysis.
Yeah,
okay.
You can talk about
The one exception that I will mention, because it's very immediately physical, is the Fresnel relations you get by looking at the propagation of light in a crystal. In almost all known physically relevant cases, the Fresnel relations factorize into second-order fragments. This is something possibly most people have forgotten, but you can go to either Born and Wolf, or you can go to various copies of Landau and Lipschitz, and they will describe for you how light will propagate in a crystal, and eventually you'll write down a Fresnel relation, which winds up being, in fact, sixth order in time. The omega square that's sitting out front actually is an artifact. It's a gauge artifact that really goes away. The real physics left is in the omega fourth term, omega squared k squared, and c squared k for the fourth term. And, of course, that thing is both p and t, satisfies both p and t, since, God help us, classical electromagnetism satisfies p and t. So no matter what you do, even with a crystal, you better actually still satisfy p and t. In almost all known cases, including uniaxial birefringent crystals, this thing factorizes, in fact, into a bunch of quadratics. Effectively, the gauge mode, the ordinary ray, and the extraordinary ray. And you wind up with a bunch of second order in time dispersion relations. Almost all cases, the one exceptional case is the so-called biaxial crystal. A biaxial crystal is what happens when you have a crystal whose dielectric constants are different in three different directions, at which stage this thing no longer factorizes, and your dispersion relation is a octic, which doesn't factorize into anything nice, and it is just ugly to deal with. But that is the only exceptional case I know of in everyday physics. We don't, but eventually I'm going to short-circuit this part of the argument, but we don't know that. But again, it's a matter of one thing at a time. Let's try to keep things as straightforward as possible. So my next working hypothesis too is I'm going to try and keep things second order in time, which means that I've really got to have something that's a linear combination of this omega squared term and the omega minus bk term, and then the other remaining two terms. Of course, now I play a trick. If I take this thing and this thing, I can combine them into a single term with coefficient a plus b up front and a modified definition of the thing v by simply just completing the square on this thing. And what have I got now? This thing, which I deduced by saying I want something second order in time, has to be something out of the form omega minus vk squared plus something of the form v bar dot k squared. So I'll just dump that bit in here. And now you can see how I'm going to go step by step through this, because now I've reduced it to now my sixth improved version of the dispersion relation is now some function f6 of omega minus v dot k squared. I've still got a v dot k squared to live with, and a h bar kikj. Appeal to the implicit function theorem. I can write that as a statement about the omega minus v dot k squared. Finally, I can just drop the unnecessary subscripts and the unnecessary bars, and I've got that sort of dispersion relation. And at this stage, those of you who have been following what I've been doing for the last few years will realize that, wait a minute, this is a reasonably minor extension of the class of dispersion relations that people in the analog model program have been running across. Okay, now the analog model program was an attempt, or is an attempt, to try and mimic the notions of curved space-time by playing with condensed matter systems, typically fluid condensed matter systems, and dispersion relations that were minor, well, were specializations of this, but not particularly stringent specializations of this, were showing up reasonably naturally. In fact, I'm now going to batter things over the head with a couple of other slight ideas. I emphasize at this stage that the sort of dispersion relations we got out of analog models ideas were of the form omega minus v dot k squared with some function of k squared. Here, instead of just some function of k squared, we've got some function of hkk, Well, that can be our generalized definition of what k squared means. We just treat hij as a three-dimensional metric. But we've still got this v dot k squared thing around, and I'd like to get rid of that. I emphasize at this stage I've not used any analog model reasoning. I've only used some very fundamental ideas of eminently reasonable things that you should see dropping out of the dispersion relation of almost any realistic quantum gravity theory, quantum gravity phenomenology. I mean, all I've really appealed to is PT invariance and some mild assumptions about the nature of second-order time derivatives. And I've certainly not used any notion at this stage of Lorentz invariance, approximate or otherwise. Now, for my next trick, let's start to take this V seriously as some sort of notion of velocity. I'll assume that V is some sort of physical velocity, and you could call that, for instance, the velocity of the locally preferred rest frame for Lorentz braking, or if you really want to give your colleagues heart attacks, give it a name like the velocity of the subquantic ether. Okay, now, the name you give it is completely irrelevant. If it really is some notion of physical velocity, then I should be able, through some sort of transformation, and I'm not going to specify now whether it is Lorentz, because it can't be. This is supposed to be a Lorentz breaking theory. Nevertheless, if it's a physical velocity, any sort of physical velocity, I can walk along with the thing and effectively set this thing to zero. So I'm not using now Lorentz transformation properties. I'm just saying a very, very fundamental thing. If it's a velocity, walk at that velocity. Effectively, it's not flying past you. In that local rest frame, it should drop into this form. Just omega squared is some function of hi, ki, kj.
You know that you can walk at that velocity.
If it's superluminal light, then you're in trouble. But that's why I said the assumption there was that it's some sort of physical velocity.
Light?
Huh? Like what?
Your light's physical.
Well, it's supposed to be a Lorentz violating theory. Still travel at speed light. Do it. I will say this is not supposed to be a rigorous derivation. This is supposed to be a motivation making clear what assumptions are going in and what
are. I may say that the particle is exactly what it has, which is the required velocity of the defect. There you can go to the rest frame of the defect.
Yep. But that is in a particular framework where you want to work with your brains and D0 particles and the like. I want to some extent, strip this of as much excess baggage as possible and see how much really comes out of, and make it clear what the assumptions are you're putting in.
But so here you're assuming that there is some set of transformations that are, you know, in some sense the good ones, that are good for your theory that you can use.
No, I'm not even saying I need a transformation. I'm just saying that, hey, there's some velocity, I walk along with that velocity. So it's just a very basic statement that the velocity in question should be a physical one, and that I can travel with that particular velocity. Now, the type of transformation that does this, God alone knows, it's not likely to be a Lorentz transformation, it's not going to be a Galilean transformation.
In the D particle, it is a Galilean.
Yeah, right. In the D particle model.
Sure.
So in some particular models, it is. Okay. But at this stage, I've gotten down to a suggestion that it's quite reasonable under P&T invariance, some limitation on the notion of the order of time derivatives you're willing to tolerate, and if that thing is a physical velocity with, so that you can travel at that velocity, then you're pretty naturally into this sort of dispersion relation, at least in the co-moving local frame associated with this subquantic ether, whatever you want to call it. Of course, at this stage, I can start playing the standard games of defining the usual notion of a phase velocity simply by taking omega squared and dividing it by k squared. It's slightly generalized because I've got this 3x3 matrix in here, which is a 3x3 matrix that roughly is going to wind up being my three-dimensional spatial metric. And so at this stage, you've got certainly notions of phase velocity, and you can extend it to notions of group velocity, and it's dropping out relatively natural under three sets of hypotheses. And now the one you're really going to hate, hypothesis four. No one can stop me from doing a Galilean transformation, and I'm not going to claim it is a symmetry. It is merely a convenient choice of coordinates. I do this in space. It induces a change on the cotangent bundle. It is not a symmetry of the theory, but what it is a statement that there will be a coordinate system, a convenient coordinate system, in which the dispersion relation takes on this relatively simple form. Yep. Nice trick. And in fact, if you stop to think about it, the way I set this thing up, H2, by the time I've gotten through to H4, becomes redundant. But the reason I kept H2 in there was because in some sense it's more elementary, and people are more likely to start complaining at me as I go through my list of hypotheses. So H1, hardly anyone's going to get upset about. H2, there's technical issues. H3, there's a fundamental issue, what's a real physical velocity, can I move at that speed? H4, at this stage, it's like, whoa. But once you've done that, what you've got now out of essentially any theory that is P&T invariant and satisfies those other H2, H3, H4 hypotheses, you've got something that's very, very similar to what comes out of the standard analog models. Now, forget. The point of this is, of course, is that this gives me some confidence that whatever insights I'm getting out of the analog model program are not really tied down specifically to the analog model program. They're likely to be reasonably generic, not to every conceivable quantum gravity phenomenology I can write down, but to a large class of quantum gravity phenomenologies I can write down. Okay? And, of course, the standard things I like to talk to people about is, say, analog spacetimes, like playing around with Bose-Einstein condensates and looking at the dispersion relation that we've measured in a Bose-Einstein condensate, the Bogle-Yerbov dispersion relation, it's a physical example of a dispersion relation that exhibits what we might call the breakdown of the analog of Lorentz invariance at high energy. So there are honest-to-God condensed matter models that give us physical examples of dispersion relations roughly of the type the quantum gravity phenomenology people want to talk about. So to give you controlled models of symmetry breaking, they're going to give you a controlled model of what a rainbow spacetime should really be, and they also give you a controlled model, at least in some approximations, of how you have the concept of emergence lying in these theories. For those people who haven't seen it, I'm going to mention briefly the notion of an acoustic spacetime. And I'll mention it because it's the simplest example of an emergent analog spacetime. It comes about when you consider sound waves in a moving fluid, and in particular, if the fluid ever goes supersonic, the sound waves can never beat their way back upstream again, and you've got the analog of a horizon. But it's more than that. There is a rigorous theorem of mathematical physics that tells you that under certain conditions, the way sound waves propagate in a real moving fluid is mathematically identical to dealing with a curved spacetime. Now, the theorem is you consider a fluid that is non-relativistic, irrotational, so no vorticity, inviscid, no viscosity. Barotropic, meaning density of the function of pressure only, and I'm not going to worry about entropy generation and stuff like that. Then in a fluid of that type, the linearized perturbations, otherwise known as sound waves, or if you're a quantum mechanic, you'll call them a phonon, the linearized perturbations actually satisfy a D'Alembertian equation involving a metric that is an acoustic metric, which is an algebraic function of the background fields, and that metric you can actually calculate as a explicit function of the density of the fluid, the velocity of the fluid, and the speed of sound in the fluid. And I emphasize that this is a rigorous theorem of applied mathematics, and it is a rigorous example of how Lorentzian geometry is not just tied to the notion of general relativity and space-time. Lorentzian geometries show up quite naturally in other systems. Just don't try to add vorticity to the system. It's beyond belief what happens once you try to add vorticity. But as long as you're working within these limitations, it is clear that you do have an analog for a metric. In particular, if I've got something like a Bose-Einstein condensate, the velocity, because it's a condensate, is automatically irrotational. So the velocity field in a Bose-Einstein condensate automatically satisfies these constraints. And so for low-frequency excitations of a Bose-Einstein condensate, this logic goes through completely, where c is now the speed of sound, rho naught really is the density of the condensate in number of atoms per cubic centimeter, and v is the physical flow velocity of the condensate. Now, I mention that because this is one of the simplest examples of what's going on. And now I'm going to jump right back to the general case, where I've got some sort of phase velocity, and I've got some dispersion relation of the form omega minus v dot k squared is phase velocity times hij ki kj. And I'm going to use this now to try and pick off a momentum-dependent notion of space-time metric. So now I'm going to go beyond the rigorous theorem I just showed you, which of course worked only in the low-frequency limit, where the speed of sound was just a fixed speed over and done with. I've now got a phase velocity for sound that depends on momentum, and I'll make it a function of k squared just to indicate, you know, it should be parity invariant. And so it better depend on the square. So this really is not k squared. This is hki kj. I've just shortened it by saying it's k squared. But this dispersion relation lets you pick off a momentum-dependent notion of rainbow metric. And you do this by just writing a four-vector k, which is just omega k. And you write your dispersion relation in the form of some sort of g, which depends on k squared, contracted with k twice is zero, and it's certainly of that form. You then pick off your components, and notice here proportional sign. Proportional because if something equals zero, five times something equals zero. And you do not have enough information from this sort of analysis to specify the conformal factor that might be sitting out front. You do in the case of that rigorous theorem I gave you in terms of fluid dynamics, because you're actually sitting down and linearizing the fluid dynamical equations. Here I'm just playing with a dispersion relation, so I don't have quite as much information. I can't do this, I can't fix the conformal factor, but by God, I can at least fix to a very large degree the form of the metric, both indices up, indices down form. Those of you who have done a lot of, say, numerical relativity will realize that this is awfully similar. Well, if you get rid of the k squared, this will be awfully similar to the ADM decomposition of the metric that is used when you're developing canonical quantum gravity. And part of the message I want to get through to people is that that ADM type decomposition is relatively natural in a large class of theories based on reasonable ideas of what we might expect a quantum gravity phenomenology to be. Of course, this rainbow metric depends on the phase velocity, and it's depending on the phase velocity ultimately because this rainbow metric is simply a different way of codifying the dispersion relation. Now I can try a totally different game. Oh, sorry. I'll mention a couple of things. The weakness of this approach is that the conformal factor is left unspecified. And the reason for that is it's because the dispersion relation approach always suffers from this weakness, simply because it shows up in geometrical acoustics, geometrical optics. Anytime you take the Eichenhall approximation, you've thrown away some information by doing that. And turns out the piece of information you've thrown away has been the overall conformal factor. If you know what the fundamental partial differential equations are for the system, then you can often calculate what the conformal factor has to be. Okay, but that does require additional information about the particular system you're playing with. Now, I can play similar games now that I've got a group velocity that depends on momentum. Sorry, I've got a phase velocity that depends on momentum. I can calculate a group velocity in the standard way. And I can look at a wave packet centered on momentum k and ask, where does that wave packet move if I let it propagate for a certain amount of time? And the relation between the distance it moves and the velocity of the background and the group velocity is exactly this thing. Big surprise, dx minus vdt, yeah, is the group velocity times the amount of time it's propagated. But you look at this thing, it's quadratic in the dx's and the dt's, so I can write that as some sort of momentum-dependent metric, indices down, dxa, dxb equals zero. And now I've got a separate momentum-dependent group metric, one that depends on the group velocity. So I've got at least two different rainbow metrics I can play with that encode different parts of the physics. One of them gives you information about the dispersion relations, and the other one gives you information about the wave packets. Now, some of you were in Trieste a few months ago where I gave a related talk, and at that stage I was making comments that were very much tied to the acoustic model picture, or rather to the analog model picture of these dispersion relations. And the real message I want to get through to those people who are at both conferences is that now I've come to the realization that this sort of phenomena is likely to be generic to a much larger class of models than just the models you get out of playing with analog spacetimes. In particular, this behavior now is satisfied by any model that satisfies those hypotheses I gave you, H1 through to H4. The two particular metrics I've given you now, as I say, encode different bits of information. If you're lucky, there's a hydrodynamic limit at low momenta where the group velocity and the phase velocity converge on each other. That doesn't have to be the case. There are physical situations in which there is no hydrodynamic limit, and the zero momentum limit of phase and group velocity simply do not converge on each other, in which case you never wind up with a monometric theory. You'd always wind up with a sort of bimetric theory. Okay, physical reality, as far as we can tell, is to extremely good approximation monometric at relatively low momenta. So we want to have some sort of hydrodynamic limit if we're going to try and describe our reality. In general, I can play the same game with any other decent notion of speed you can play with. So I've done it explicitly with phase and group velocity. If you do it with hydrodynamic velocity, you're back to the results of that rigorous theorem on fluid mechanics. I could shove in the signal velocity. Of course, this requires me to do a sidestep on what exactly signal velocity is. If you are trying to do phenomenology, it's important to know whether or not the dispersion relation is superluminal or subluminal. If you're trying to address the deeper issues of quantum gravity, you really want to know ultimately what the causal structure is like. And the causal structure, I would say, is governed by the critical question of, is the signal velocity finite or infinite? Now, I'll give two plausible definitions of signal velocity. The most standard one that people use in the literature is to look at the infinite momentum limit of the phase velocity. And the reason people do that is, think of having a discontinuity in the field, like you have, say, at the sharp front of a signal pulse, you're trying to send down a wire. You know that if you've got a sharp pulse here and you Fourier transform it, you have all frequencies up to infinity. And so the logic that is used is, because you want to have all frequencies up to infinity, it is the phase velocity at infinite momentum that governs how rapidly that pulse can propagate. It won't be undistorted. It's likely to be distorted to hell. But this is the logic, and I will mention that this definition of signal velocity is extremely standard. It's almost I think that is the gold-plated standard people work with. It's sometimes easier to think of it in the other way. Look at the maximum of all momenta of the group velocity. Because a group, after all, is a little wave packet, and you can think of sending that down the wire to send a signal, you know. So if you maximize the group velocity, you're maximizing the rate at which useful data can be sent down some sort of communications channel. And this one is actually likely to be a better definition for engineers who really have to transfer data. So this first definition focuses on discontinuities and how they propagate. The second definition focuses on how rapidly you can transmit a packet of information. And yes, they're interrelated, because remember, there's a relation between group velocity and phase velocity. The key point for practitioners of quantum gravity is this. As long as the signal velocity is finite, then your overall causal structure will be similar to that of general relativity, except instead of light cones, you'll be having signal cones whose width is governed by the signal velocity. And you're still going to have this cone-like structure governing what is going on. But if the signal velocity is infinite, you're actually at a global level looking at something that's much more closer to Newtonian physics. Okay? And that might not be the first thing to test phenomenologically, but I think that that is an important point for practitioners to realize, is that when you start digging into the real bowels of what's going on, the finiteness or non-finiteness of the signal velocity may actually be more significant in terms of dealing with the fundamentals. The distinction between superluminal and subluminal dispersion relations is very important for phenomenology, because it impacts on particle physics thresholds. It constrains allowable particle interactions. Remember, you can't have photon dividing into two photons, not in special relativity. But as soon as you violate special relativity with a suitable dispersion relation, you can actually have photons splitting in that way. But these things are addressing separate and slightly different questions. And I would say that ultimately it's this question of the overall causal structure that might be more important for understanding the guts of it. I mentioned before the Bose-Einstein condensates. But this dispersion relation exists not just in Bose-Einstein condensates. It also shows up in superconductors. And it gives you a dispersion relation for for phonons in a superconductor. In the case of a Bose-Einstein condensate, the mass in question here is the mass of the atoms that are undergoing the condensation. In the case of phonons in a superconductor, the mass that's in there is actually the mass of the Cooper pairs, because the phonons in question are fluctuations in the Coupon. The phase velocity, well, there's some constant plus some constant larger one. So the phase velocity is definitely heading off to infinity. This does not mean it's superluminal, okay? Superluminal means you have to look at the group velocity. If the phase velocity goes to infinity, that happens in ordinary special relativity. Take an electron at low momentum, calculate its phase velocity, it's greater than light, okay? It's the group velocity for real particles in standard special relativity that is less than light. Now, if you go through that extra exercise, and I'm not going to do it here, yes, this is a full-fledged supersonic dispersion relation. So it is the analog in a condensed matter setting of what would be a superluminal dispersion relation in a quantum physics setting.
Problem. You measure instabilities in the whatever you call superluminal blanks. I used two superfluids together, and you found one.
Oh, yeah.
So this instability might have something.
Oh, there's some very interesting instabilities, like, a Bose-Einstein condensate, it looks like seeing that supersonic is no big deal. If you take a superconductor, at least type 1 superconductor, and try to set its slow supersonic, it's like, ooh, you've just rediscovered the concept of critical field, or rather, critical velocity. There's a critical velocity beyond which the Cooper pair just fall apart. And, yeah, so you do always have to be aware of potential limitations with the analog you're playing with. As far as we can tell, the Bose-Einstein condensate does not have this particular defect once you go supersonic, basically because it's not the sound waves that are actually holding the Bose-Einstein condensate together, whereas it is the sound waves that are holding the Cooper pairs together. So at some stage, it's not too bloody surprising that if you send the flow supersonic, something is going to happen to the Cooper pairs. But here's another example you can play with, and there's a reason I'm going to play with this one. This is surface waves in a finite depth of liquid. And this is a beautiful result that goes back all the way to Horace Lamb with that marvelous Big Thuk book on hydrodynamics that was published somewhere in the 1860 or thereabouts, and is still being reissued by Dover to this day. And if you've got a finite depth of liquid, it turns out the depth of the liquid shows up in your dispersion relation. Great. And in this case, it turns out the dispersion relation is subsonic. And the point here is that with these analog models, you can very naturally both get supersonic and subsonic dispersion relations. There's no obvious reason coming from the condensed matter physics why supersonic or subsonic should be ruled out, and it is worth testing both. Here's a nasty one. Surface waves in the infinite depth of liquid, omega goes as the square root of g, the acceleration due to gravity, times the square root of k. Now let's think about that for a sec. That means omega squared equals k. Wait a minute. Left-hand side is invariant under parity and time reversal. Right-hand side, k, is not invariant under parity and time reversal. What the hell has happened here? Because this dispersion relation, since it's equivalent to omega squared proportional to k, seems to violate my rules for being parity invariant. But I'm just working with hydrodynamics. Okay.
But it's the amplitude of k, isn't it? It's not the vector in wave probability.
No, it's actually a little trickier than that. It is actually, well, it's the magnitude of k, but how do you construct the magnitude of k in a system where, how do you construct it? You construct it by looking, taking k squared and square rooting it. It's actually more subtle, because what you've really got there is that your true dispersion relation is this, and you're looking at the limit where D is becoming very, very large. So what you've actually got is your fundamental dispersion relation clearly is invariant under parity, and the apparent violation of parity is only coming out in this unphysical infinite depth limit. Does this have a message for quantum gravity? I would say yes, it does. Suppose I desperately want k cubed terms in the dispersion relation in quantum gravity phenomenology. Now, I've got two ways of doing this. I could put in explicit parity violation into my model, even though I don't particularly have a good reason for doing it. Or I could see, can I fake something that looks like a parity violating term based on this intuition of what's happening here in this fluid dynamic picture? And the answer is yes, or I wouldn't be giving this little talk. Here's how to fake a cubic term. Consider this dispersion relation. I'll give my excitation a mass. I'll give it the standard special relativity form. I'll then add a k to the fourth term, suppressed by some scale k1. And I'll multiply it by this little trick of a tenth divided by k. Now, I've got two different scales here, k1 and k2. k1 is governing the momentum scale at which Lorentz breaking is becoming significant. K2 is a momentum scale characterizing apparent parity breaking. The dispersion relation by construction is completely parity invariant. And I've needed two different physical scales here to get apparent parity violation. If I want to get a k cubed term that's phenomenologically interesting, that is not depressed so far that it's completely unobservable, then I need to have the apparent parity breaking scale to be much lower than the Lorentz violating scale. So the only ways I can think of getting a k cubed term, which are the phenomenologically interesting ones to do phenomenological tests on, is either to explicitly break parity in the theory or to effectively break parity by introducing an extra scale. Fine. Okay. In particular, remember the Gambini and Pullen dispersion relation, they had a k-cubed term. The way they got the parity breaking in there was actually with the weave state that they were working with, because their fundamental theory does not break parity, but the particular weave state that they were working with to do their calculation, that was chosen specifically to break parity, and that's how they were able to get a k-cubed term showing up. I'll mention you can do slightly other things, different things. I can add surface tension. And one of the cute things you can do with surface tension is now you have something that's a sort of hybrid. If I just had the surface tension term here, that'd look like the Bolyubov dispersion relation you get for BECs and you get for superconductors. If I switch off the surface tension, I just have what I was talking about before, which is surface waves in a finite depth of liquid. If I do exactly the right things with water, okay, in particular, if I decide I'm going to look at water that is half a centimeter deep, I can actually tune things to get rid of the lowest order Lorentz violating term. Okay, and again, this is a useful message for people doing quantum gravity phenomenology. You may have a number of effects to deal with, and you want to be careful that you don't have your two effects canceling out. Okay, it may be just bad luck that two effects cancel out. It may be you have to fine-tune. It may be useful to actually suppress Lorentz violation as much as possible. That depends on what the phenomenological and observational system turns out to be. And so, again, I would suggest to people that it is useful to motivate their ideas of what to look at by looking at some of these analog models and seeing the sort of dispersion relations we see. I will also mention it's possible to generate particle masses, and Silke is going to be talking about that in a few minutes, I think. And the idea is here that, you know, phonons are massless. Giving the phonon a mass is a slightly tricky game, but yes, it can be done. The basic message I want to give here is there are lots of physically well-behaved and well-controlled models for various sorts of beyond-standard model physics that come out of these analog model program. And the analog model program naturally gives you the sorts of dispersion relations that people maybe should be looking at. I would say that in conclusion, the analog space-time framework is very natural and plausible from the point of view of quantum gravity phenomenology. This is not because this is a theory of quantum gravity. This is simply a set of ideas that tells us which rocks to start looking under. Thank you.
So, thanks to Max Fischer. Is there any other questions?
Of course, for quantum gravity, you not only, as I said, the dispersion relations which could preserve time reversal, then you have the truly quantum effects. So, for instance, then you have decoherence, which would violate microscopically your time arrows, but this has nothing to do with the dispersion relations. I mean,
eventually, of course, a more fundamental theory, there will be decoherence, there will be all of these number of things to start thinking about, but they're unlikely to be showing up as the first and most obvious thing.
I mean, this example shows that. You have a special relation like yours with the B, where the B is very quite a lot, so it's everything is fine, it's time reversed, so the Hamiltonian is okay, but then you may have decoherence due to degrees of freedom, where you can have a time arrow for other reasons. That's what I maybe
that. In negative three, we have two good standards, no?
Do we?
Pardon? What do you say?
In helium 3.
Helium 3. Helium 4. I think that.
Too big in the sense of direction, pilot direction. Is that what you say? Or
I think.
Careful.
The mechanism that.
Actually, in helium 3, I think because you've got a director field that's floating around as well.
Is it a director or
the
direction of the field?
So there you have. But what I was saying is that is an explicit example when you have a parity violation.
Yeah, but
they are not models.
Yeah, but it's explicit. Again, it's explicit.
Again, but you see, so in a sense, you have an argument to say that CPT was somehow something that you want to force as fundamental.
No. My argument was more subtle. It's, well, CPT, I'd like to hold on to as long as possible, but C, P, and T are properties of Einstein gravity. So when we start looking for quantum gravity phenomenology that's going to lead us to Einstein gravity, let's not explicitly violate C, P, or T unless we absolutely find we can't avoid doing so.
Of course, it's a classic.
Well, it's a possibility to look at. Yes. But there's a difference between a possibility and a probability.
I do. But
yes.
There's something in the logic that I may not understand. The analog, the whole enterprise of the analog modes gravity is to say gravity and its symmetries and its high degree of symmetry. Mm-hmm. It's an emergent property. It's not an underlying property. So why do you want to impose on the underlying theory, mm-hmm. or constrain in some sense the underlying theory, using symmetries that you discover in this emergent?
I'm not sure I'm actually trying to constrain. I'm just trying to decide on appropriate rocks to look under. I cannot. I mean, the analog model program, if I've only got one excitation around, say one single scalar excitation, I very naturally get a single metric dropping out. If I've got multiple degrees of freedom interacting with each other, typically the analog model program doesn't give you a nice single metric, it gives you a whole slew of metrics. And so to actually get, shall we say, a single metric out of an analog model program generally requires some sort of fine tuning. Effectively, you want one degree of freedom that's roughly decoupled from most of the other things going on. So I don't think people would claim that the analog model program automatically gives you, say, the equivalence principle. It sure as hell doesn't. It requires actually hard work to get something like the equivalence principle out of the analog model program. On the other hand, it does give us, shall we say, hints, and it does give us ideas. But I would hate to try and deduce anything rigorously. In fact, I don't think I can deduce anything rigorously about true quantum gravity from the analog model program.
So there's a question. I mean, all deductions aside, we have any motivations, either standard model or heuristic or wherever you pull them for the quote-unquote dielectric HIJ that you have there, if we were to apply it ever?
If we were to apply the HIJ, not really. I mean, the most obvious one is in the fluid mechanical model, the HIJ always turns out to be the identity matrix. Okay, now, that is too restrictive. Okay, it turns out with HIJ being the identity matrix, you can't even get Schwarzschild right. You can get something conformal to Schwarzschild, but you can't get true Schwarzschild, and you certainly can't get the Kerr geometry. So it's clear that if I was to try and take this seriously to then try and, say, model the Schwarzschild and the Kerr spacetimes, I'm going to have to do something with the HIJ, and it's going to have to be something a little bit more complicated than just some sort of constant.
It could be the Fermi surface geometry of condensed matter, if you have regularities in the Fermi surface.
In particular,
with a doped Bose-Einstein, for example.
With a doped Bose-Einstein.
Not the Fermi surface, I guess.
Yeah.
The Bose-Einstein.
I have some trivial question.
Yeah.
What's wrong, say, after you arrive at the stage where you have HIJ multiplied by VIN, say, well, let me organize and choose to measure things in coordinates so that, such that HIJ is diagonal and defines my, I mean, more than diagonal. I can choose coordinates in which is the identity, and all things disappear. What?
Things don't. Careful.
No. Things don't disappear. They become extremely simple, but they don't disappear. Yep. That's all the angle.
Okay. If HIJ was a position-independent thing, then yes, I can just do a global diagonalization, choose coordinates, be done with it. If it is position-dependent, then I can only do this in local patches, and so you would lose information by throwing that thing away. And that's one of the reasons I retained it. I mean, there was no assumption here of translation invariance of this sort of background. Neither the V's nor the H's were assumed to be...
There must be, because when you did this Galilean transformation, mm-hmm. it didn't become a time-dependent...
Local patches. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do want to have a look, at least locally, I want to be able to play games. But, the global trickery is, remember, I first said I was going to move along with the velocity of that thing. Now, that's only a local statement. And then, once I've made that local statement, I can now apply the Galilean transformation in a local sort of manner to bring me back to whatever frame I was first playing with. But, so that bit is okay. But I can't throw everything away in the H's, and I can't throw everything away in the velocity and position dependence of the V's.
If you
vorticity, let's say.
if I have vorticity,
it would not be zero, so kaput. But it's fine, I mean, that's not what you're right.
And that's finished.